benchmark, very interesting case, pregnancy, influenza, and ART.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. Thank you, Mina, for great leadership. We'll start the case. This is a tough case, and I thought maybe I'll bring a tough case for us to discuss and talk. The case really involved the whole group at AUB, and we had long discussions in managing this case, and I want to bring it up also for the group. A 26-year-old, first-time pregnant, presented to a local hospital with symptoms of runny nose, muscular aches and pains, fever 39.5 to 40, and increasing shortness of breath over 2 days prior to her presentation to the local hospital. She was 33 weeks pregnant. She was seen in the emergency room at that local hospital, and her ABGs on 10-liter nasal cannula showed a pH of 7.45, PCO2 of 32, and a PO2 of only 41 on 10-liter nasal cannula and autosat of 80%. Obviously, the ER physician noted there's something definitely wrong. The patient was given IV steroids, took blood cultures. They took a nasal wash for influenza antigen. It was told to me that the influenza antigen was positive. We could not verify that later. But anyway, they took the influenza antigen and transferred the patient to the emergency room at AUBMC. This is her chest X-ray when she came to our emergency room. There is bilateral dense predominant lower lobe infiltrates noted on the chest X-ray. So in the emergency department, patient was in acute respiratory distress. The ABGs on 100% face mask. Again, severe respiratory, severe hypoxemia, pH 7.45, PCO2 of 32, a PO2 of 41, and the O2 saturation again was 80%. White count was not elevated, hemoglobin hematocrit was okay, kidney function was okay, liver functions were okay, no anemia, no thrombocytopenia, no evidence for HELLP syndrome, coags were all normal. So the patient was immediately intubated in the emergency room, placed on mechanical ventilation, and placed on tidal volume of 400, FiO2 of 100%, PEEP 10, and the ABGs came back, pH 7.35, PCO2 of 35, and PO2 of 81 and 94% saturation. Medications, she was obviously started on antiviral treatment, loaded with all the antibiotics that we can think of, and was given Lovenox 40 milligrams sub-Q, sedated with a combination of propofol and midazolam, and was given also an Imbex later on. And this is how she was in the emergency room, and the question came up, and between us, the OBGYN, the ER doctors, and everybody in the hospital, what to do, then what's the next step? A, and we'd like to vote on this, A, optimize the patient, treat her medically, and admit to the ICU, and hope for the best. B, proceed with regular Pitocin induction and admit to the intensive care unit. C, take the patient from the ER straight to the operating room and proceed with a C-section. And D, actually, surgery may be contraindicated and put a lot of burden on the respiratory system, worsening her ARDS, and can be risky to the mother and the fetus. Please vote and give me what you think we should do. And there's actually no good answer to this case. And obviously, it's a very tough case and a tough decision. And let me go over them, the different chances. And I went over and reviewed the literature. This is a picture from the research on from the PubMed. There's obviously 1,677 mentioning of ARDS and pregnancy, and all of them really would not help me to make a decision on whether what to do with the patient. It's all suggestions, but nobody would have really given us objective way of deciding what to do with this patient. And this is this is one of the articles, and they say it's the most challenging decision. And delivery, obviously, if we were able to get the baby out, the delivery will improve the maternal oxygenation and will improve the cardiovascular system of the patient if we got the baby out, because that will cut down on the work of breathing and will cut down on the metabolic load on the cardiovascular system. And the second thing, however, if would she able to handle the surgery, and the labor and or cesarean delivery may be an acceptably high risk for this patient. So there's really nothing in the literature. Anyway, they were discussing this in the emergency room, and between all of us, we decided to go ahead and proceed with the C-section. So the patient was taken straight to the operating room. And again, there's no good answer how to go in this case. The baby was actually in a critical condition. He was intubated and taken to our NICU. And the patient was then sent back to us in the ICU. She got a little bit better. Day two post-op, the ABGs, tidal volume 400, PEEP 10, FI2 was able to go down to 70%. PH was 7.36, and the PO2 went up to 84. She remained heavily sedated, and the antibiotics were continued. So we thought we're doing okay at this point until the next day four, and the X-ray was noted on a routine daily X-ray. And if you look at the neck, I don't know if it's projecting very well, but in the neck there is significant subcutaneous emphysema noted bilaterally in the neck. This subcutaneous emphysema was noted on a routine chest X-ray. There was no hypotension, no increase in the plateau or peak pressures. The vent setting remained the same, and the oxygenation was acceptable. So we have this finding on the X-ray and practically nothing else on physical exam or in the vitals. So my next question is what to do now. Conservative approach. Observe for now with daily X-ray and continuous monitoring on the ventilatory data, i.e. look at the peak or look at the plateau. Switch to airway pressure release ventilation. Limit barotrauma by decreasing the PEEP. Immediate placement of bilateral chest tubes or switch to pressure control ventilation. Can you vote, please?
Okay. See the results? Yeah. Come in again.
Good spread.
Yeah.
And I think there's actually no good answer for it, but let me go over how we thought this case. The conservative approach, obviously, we want to monitor the blood pressure, the oxygen saturation. We can see if there's anything wrong and then react accordingly. I felt that could be very risky because especially at night with any change in the oxygenation, any change in the blood pressure, we're going to worry that this now evolved into attention pneumothorax. And the resident's going to jump in and put a chest tube and the lung is up. We may have more lung injury. We may have more a problem. I felt that this option is a little bit too risky in this kind of case because, you know, the changes in the oxygen saturation in her can be very tricky. This was the first. Now, the second thing is APRV. We certainly can do that. And I looked into the literature. There is definitely some theory behind it. There's no real data, but the theory behind it is with conventional ventilation, recruitment of the lung is by raising the tidal volume or the PEEP, and this will definitely increase the end inflation stretch of the lungs and will increase the ventilation-induced lung injury. With APRV, there is a longer inflation duration without adding extra to the end inflation stretch, and from that point, you know, APRV may reduce the end inflation and may reduce ventilator-induced lung injury. So this is where APRV can work, and we switch the patient to APRV. Now, the second thing is limiting barotrauma by increasing or decreasing the PEEP. Again, we went through the literature, and there's really not a whole lot of information how to go. Even with low PEEP, may worsen the atelectotrauma, which means the alveoli are going to pop in and pop out, and when they are deflated and inflated again, this creates a shear force and may worsen actually the barotrauma and worsen the leak. Higher PEEP, traditionally from the literature, showing that it is a relative high risk in our patients. So I really didn't know what to do with the PEEP, and there is no evidence that lowering the PEEP or hiding the PEEP would really affect our decision. And the consensus in the literature is mortality, no mortality benefit with higher PEEP. Optimal PEEP remain to be determined. This is in a Cochrane review. So again, the PEEP, I couldn't really make a decision on it. And the literature doesn't help you with that. The third thing is to switch to a pressure control ventilation. We always do that. We say, okay, we want to make sure the plateau is not going to go above this point, and I think that will help the patient. Again, a recent Cochrane review came out in 2015, in January 2015, which looked into all these randomized controlled trials, and there is, again, the consensus that, you know, we cannot confirm or refute that pressure-controlled ventilation or volume-controlled ventilation is going to give you any advantage in limiting barotrauma. So these three, this option is probably not very helpful. So I decided to go ahead and proceed in placement of bilateral chest tubes. I called my cardiothoracic team, and I told them, we want you to do them because the lungs are up, and I don't want to cause any further injury to the lungs. They came in. They put two chest tubes. There was no gush of air noted, no change in the or improvement in the oxygenation, and the patient remained hemodynamically stable with these two chest tubes put in. Now, day six, she remained hemodynamically stable, but continued to be febrile. Our infectious disease team were on the case and added medications, and they included the antifungal. But we started having worsening of the oxygenation, a pH of 7.34, a PCO2 of 72, and a PO2 of 56. This is 26 or 27-year-old, and we're having a worsening oxygenation with time. So the next step is what we're going to do. High-frequency jet ventilation, increase the PEEP further and lower PC, more hypercapnia, start a prone positioning, or go ahead and ask your group to bring in ECMO and start working on this patient. Please vote now. Again, we have a good spread, and because, as I told you, this is a tough case and anything can go. Let me start with the high-frequency jet ventilation. Obviously, in all these elements, you have to know what your intensive care unit is able to do. And if your intensive care unit is going to start a new protocol, you may get in trouble. And remember, this is a 26-year-old patient, and if we have a complication from a new procedure, the family and the whole environment is going to be very, very upset, because we need to make sure we have a protocol and a procedure that we can handle the complications of it. The high-frequency jet ventilation, we do have one available at AUBMC. We have not used it for a while. And obviously, the literature does not really support high-frequency jet ventilation anymore. No one is probably using it in ARDS, or very few are. And in this particular case, there is an increased incidence of worsening pneumothorax, and worsening hyperinflation of the lung and increased pressure on the lung. So the lung is already diseased lung and fibrotic and leaking air. You probably should not put high-frequency jet ventilation on this patient. Okay? Now, more hypercapnia, yes, we can do that. We can paralyze the patient more, and we can knock out her minute ventilation. We were doing this, and we've added, as we worked on this patient, we've added more sedation, lowered the volumes, and the minute ventilation, and that was an ongoing process. The third thing is to do the ECMO, the extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. And again, I mentioned this as a new thing that is coming up, and obviously we're all excited about it. It is obviously a learning experience for the medical center that's going to implement it. And we have purchased the equipment at AUBMC, but unfortunately, the McGee is a four-month delay in getting it, so we have not got it yet. So we are now using a combination of Novalung and stuff from the operating room, and we've placed that before. At the point that we had the patient, the issue of ECMO in pregnancy and postpartum, and I looked into the literature, and there is the increased risk of maternal and fetal bleeding complication. Remember, we're going to anticoagulate this patient very heavily, and she just had a C-section. Even during pregnancy or postpartum, or any patient who had surgical procedure, the intense anticoagulation, you worry about bleeding. So this was something that we worried about. And again, there was no consensus on the optimal anticoagulation in patients who had surgery and you want to put them in ECMO. So in this kind of environment, we were thinking about it, but we said, let's go ahead and start proning position. And because it's readily, despite the fact that the patient had two chest tubes, a central line, and an abdominal wound, and obviously the ET tube, we were actually able to prone this patient. I'm showing you an X-ray. This is while we're doing one time the proning. There's obviously worsening pneumothorax on the right, because this one of the we were trying to rotate the patient. One of the tubes actually was pulled out, so it's not something that is clearly safe. You know, you have to monitor the patient. But the interesting part of it is the oxygenation improved dramatically in this case. And I have before and after, and the PO2 actually went up to 130 and remained high for a while by just proceeding with the proning. So this was actually a very positive findings when we were doing the prone position of this patient. So we continued with proning, and actually our patient benefited from pruning. Pruning gave us, prone positioning, gave us an additional 15 days of adequate oxygenation. But in this case, unfortunately, she had a persistent and relentless worsening of her clinical condition. And by the day 15 or 16, I was fully convinced that she is already in a fibrotic phase and the lungs are practically destroyed. And we were not able to help this patient. There was no evidence of any recovery despite an additional 2 weeks of good oxygenation that was really provided to us by doing the prone positioning. This is her chest X-ray on day 17 and day 19. Day 19 is not projecting very well, but when we looked at the X-ray, clearly more of a fibrotic lungs than a diffuse ground glass appearance that was noted on initial admission. This on day 27, patient displayed septic picture. Day 25 displayed septic picture, blood culture started growing, MRSA, and the ABGs just before actually she expired, pH 7.41, PCO2 of 71, and PO2 of 44, and patient expired on day 27. The only silver lining in this very, very sad case is that the baby went home and is doing well, but he went home without a mother. One more thing I want to mention, which really shocked me, but it's important information, is that the issue of pregnancy and severe influenza is really not a joke. This is a study done by the California Department of Public Health, and they looked into all the cases in 2013, 2014, and they found that 94% of those cases are in the second or third trimester, and that the influenza antigen that we really swear by is really only 14% positive. Which means that the patient who tested positive by PCR, they looked back and only 14% tested positive by the rapid influenza diagnostic test. And most of the cases presented with, like our patient, bilateral infiltrates and hypoxia, and out of those who required mechanical ventilation, 80% died. So it's a very bad disease in pregnancy in the second or third trimester. And the recommendation by the Department of Health in the state of California, pregnant women with suspected influenza should receive prompt empiric antiviral treatment regardless of the rapid influenza diagnostic test and regardless of the vaccination. And they insist that we should be very aggressive. I think this message should go to the OBGYN in immunizing pregnant patients because the influenza in them is not a joke. Thank you very much. Right on. She was on vancomycin. It was sensitive to vancomycin. But initially, she was placed on vancomycin, and we continued that because we were worried about a pneumococcus resistant. So the ID people placed her on vancomycin and remained through it.
So we had this even.
But the culture came on the result of the culture came on the 25th because we kept culturing her throughout. And on 25th, we had a culture of MRSA, but she was already covered with the antibiotics.
Is there any advantage to doubling the dose of Tamiflu from the beginning, as you did with the dose of also azithromycin, also very high, 1 gram?
Well, the recommendations, according to our ID, is with severe hemophilus, with severe influenza, that you go with a higher dose all the time. And this is how we, in our patients, we go ahead, give them double the dose. Routinely, yes. Yes, that's how we. That's what was given to her.
Okay. Yes.
Good question. And I didn't bring that up. The issue of corticosteroids. This is a very interesting idea, and I looked into it. I did not put it in the slides. She was given steroids to mature the lungs of the baby, and I looked into whether initiating the giving her this doses of steroids, how is it affecting the immune system of the patient, and whether this steroids given in the other hospital would have made her immune system deteriorate even further. And I looked into that, and again, there is nothing into that. Okay, so, but that's a very good point. We looked into it.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you very much. Interesting. And